Welcome to the Florida Roundup, and thanks for listening this Friday. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. My co-host Tom Hudson is out this week. Help is on the way. That was the message from President Joe Biden Thursday when he met with families and first responders in Surfside, Florida. That's the site of the deadly building collapse last week that has claimed 20 lives to date. 128 people are still marked as missing. Biden met with Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, local and state officials, and he said the federal government would pick up 100% of the costs associated with response to the collapse of the 12-story Champlain Tower South condo.
We're not going anywhere.
Thank you, Mr. President.
For real. Tell me what you need. I think the job will tell you anything you ask for. We got. We have another group of teams coming from FEMA today. Again, this is your show. We just want to make sure that whatever you need.
For his part, the governor thanked President Biden for his support. It was seemingly an uncomfortable situation for Governor DeSantis to appear with Biden. Earlier this year, he had appeared to support false claims that the president was not fairly elected. Reporter Danny Rivero has been covering the Surfside building collapse and joins us now. Danny, thanks so much for being with us. You know, they paused the search and recovery effort Thursday, then resumed it Thursday night. What's the latest from the site today?
Right. So, like you mentioned, it was paused for about 15 hours yesterday, and the search is resuming. Search and rescue workers did pull two more bodies out of the rubble last night, so that's two more, and it is ongoing. It's on a slightly slower pace now because there are some persistent worries about the structural integrity of the part of the remaining structure, which was really unclear yesterday, which was why the pause happened in the first place. But they are resuming at this point.
And as the recovery effort continues, any new info you can share on theories into what might have caused the collapse?
Right. So every couple hours, it seems there's incremental reporting and we're getting a better idea of what led up to this. And I really want to shout out two outlets, the Miami Herald and USA Today have really done a lot of incredible reporting on this. And the more we learn about it, the more we learn that there were problems in the pool area, the pool deck area, that likely went back all the way to the beginning of construction. And mm-hmm. and the further reporting as it pans out, you know, the board of the condo building, they were aware of this, and it looks like they were pushing actually for some years to get some of this construction started. They faced pushback from residents, and USA Today had a really heartbreaking story out last night that was, they got documents showing that the construction work in that particular part of the pool area was actually delayed last year because the building wanted the pool to stay open to residents throughout the whole construction project, which the engineers working on it said that was essentially impossible because they needed to work in that area. And for that reason, that construction was delayed.
Oh, wow. With could be deadly results. Now, right. We're also looking at the possibility of a Hurricane Elsa bearing down on the state. How will that impact work at the site, and how are local officials preparing?
It is something that emergency workers are monitoring. These are two things that squarely fit in the wheelhouse of emergency response. So what we know, my colleague Jenny Seletovich had a report earlier. Basically, the rescue workers have been staying in tents near the collapsed building. If Hurricane Elsa does get closer to us, and it does look like we might have either a direct or a pretty close indirect impact, those tents will have to be moved. Also, residents of the nearby buildings might have to be evacuated because we don't know what high force winds could do to the rest of the remaining structure, if that could topple something. And also for the remaining residents of the neighboring area that might have to leave because of the potential of projectiles coming from the debris in strong winds. So it's really not an easy situation.
Wow. Not a good situation at all. And a perfect storm in more ways than one, the pandemic, the building collapse, severe weather. We don't know, as you said, the cause of the collapse, but the tragedy in Surfside is prompting a review not only of building codes, but also looking at the impact of water erosion and future water rise on these kinds of coastal properties. What's been the discussion about what Florida leadership should be doing to try to better prepare in the future, in terms of resiliency and also changing inspection regulations and building codes? We've been told, particularly in South Florida, that building codes have been strengthened, that they do undergo 40-year review. What changes can we see, though, expect, though, to come out of this?
Well, it's a great question, and I think there's really two levels to it, or multiple levels to it, because most building codes and regulations are at the local level. It's usually, here in South Florida, we have Miami-Dade building codes, we have Broward County building codes, and then different municipalities have their own rules. And Democratic State Senator Jason Pizzo, I talked to him yesterday, I've talked to him a couple times, he represents Surfside. He's basically calling for some statewide regulations on this that will specify that structures like this right on the coast should have somewhat different standards than buildings that are more inland. He would like to see more monitoring, more inspections more frequently for these buildings that are right on the coast, because we know just as a general fact that if you're right on the coast and you're getting that wind coming from the ocean every day, there's salt in that. And over time, it does corrode concrete. It corrodes steel that reinforces the building, the rebar. Mm-hmm. So he's basically calling for statewide legislation. And then at the local level, there could be more happening on that front as well.
Let's talk for a moment on the political dynamic between the president and the governor when they met Thursday near the building collapse site. Of course, Governor DeSantis does not want to anger former President Trump. And he's walking a tightrope as he seeks re-election and potentially runs for president himself. He did look somewhat uncomfortable at the joint press event Thursday with President Biden, although he was quick to praise the White House for their support. Governor DeSantis has even urged former President Trump not to hold a rally in Sarasota this weekend because of the Surfside tragedy. Some interesting political threads running through all this.
And former President Trump is going forward with that rally against the request of mm-hmm. Governor DeSantis. So there really are some interesting political dynamics in that exchange. Yes, I agree with you. You could see a little bit of discomfort in the governor's face. At the same time, he did praise President Biden and his response. And, they have been working collaboratively. This is actually one example of people at all levels of government just appearing to put politics aside. Mm-hmm. If you look into the future, the question that some people are asking is, how could those images come back to haunt him? I hate to be cynical in that way, but there is precedent to that.
Yeah, you think of Charlie Crist hugging Barack Obama in Florida at an event. He paid a political price for that. Yep.
Governor Chris Christie in New Jersey appearing at an event with President Obama after Hurricane Sandy. Mm-hmm. Both of those incidents, the imagery of that came back to haunt them politically, which is really unfortunate, but it is a reality, and it is something that might be on the governor's radar. I don't know. I don't want to put words in his mouth, but he did look uncomfortable. But at the same time, they are working together, and that is a fact, and they're doing it.
Good to see that, at least when human lives are at stake. Reporter right. Danny Rivero of WLRN, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the instability of the Surfside condo tower shocked the world. Housing instability of another kind, though, has Florida real estate experts somewhat concerned this month. They think the Sunshine State's go-go housing market could be overvalued and that we could soon see a correction of sorts. Ken Johnson has been looking into this. He's associate dean, professor, and real estate expert at Florida Atlantic University's College of Business. Professor and Dean Johnson, good to have you on the Florida Roundup.
Glad to be here.
And we're talking real estate, Florida. We want to hear from you. This is such a hot topic right now. Maybe you're trying to buy a house. Maybe you're trying to sell or rent a house. Are you a realtor? How crazy are things out there right now in the real estate world? Are you concerned about prices coming back down? Give us a call as we talk housing and real estate here on the Florida Roundup from every corner of the state. The number to join us, 305-995-1800. Tweets at Florida Roundup. So, Ken Johnson, is the real estate market overvalued? Are we in something of a bubble? Could it burst?
So we are definitely paying a premium right now above prices where we would otherwise be expected to pay based on, depending on the data stream you use, between 25 years worth of data or 40 plus years worth of data. We're paying a premium of around 18% right now. Now, that sounds like a very daunting number, but if you go back and compare it to where we were in 2006 at the peak of the cycle, the premium was coming in at around 65%. So are we overpaying right now? Yes. Is it anywhere near as bad as it was a decade and a half ago? No. If you compare it to earlier peaks, if you will, and they technically were bubbles, but they didn't follow with crashes, we're much higher above that. We had peaks in 80, 83, and 89 in our market here without any catastrophic effect.
Interesting. When we compare it to the numbers from the crash of 2008, 2009. But let's talk about what's driving the high prices. There's fewer houses on the market. Mortgage rates are really low, and a lot of people have been moving here in the pandemic. Those are all sort of driving this situation right now, aren't they?
Those are clearly the three main drivers. Personally, I think it's the shortage in inventory, which has been a decade and a half in the making across the nation and here in Southeast Florida as well, that we're just not going to make up this shortage in housing. And in an odd way, there's a coming real estate event, but in an odd way, this inventory shortage will help prop up prices through this event. I just don't see anything similar to what happened a decade and a half ago happening again. And one of the main drivers to that is the fact that we've got such a shortage on inventory. And additionally, you throw on people are moving here and we have these incredibly low interest rates.
It's just amazing. And give us a call as we talk real estate on the show, 305-995-1800. Now, if you're a homeowner looking to sell, you'd seemingly be in an incredibly good situation, Ken, except for the fact that you have to have somewhere to go. if you sell your house, where are you going to go? There aren't a lot of places to buy. They go so quickly and above asking price. And people are engaging in these insane bidding wars to get the few properties that are available. What have been your thoughts as you've observed all of this?
Exactly. This is a game of musical chairs. You know, my wife this morning asked me, should we sell the house for like the 10th time? I'm like, no. Because we don't want to be the ones left out in the game of musical chairs if we sell and we're out there looking. And there's just not much inventory to choose from right now. So many people are going to the sidelines and just saying, I'm going to set this one out right now, because they don't want to get caught either, you know, transitioning, letting their lease expire, transitioning to ownership, or selling and then trying to transition to another form or another ownership in another home, or maybe even into renting, because we're scarce on properties all across the board. So a lot of people are simply just setting this one out at this point in time. So you can see the number of listings going down, the number of transactions, while still rising, the number of mortgage applications are dropping sharply at this point in time, which are a harbinger of what's to come. So I think you're going to see a lot of people setting this out for a while, and that should help cool prices, which isn't, my estimation, is a good thing.
And you think that's a good thing. We'll talk about why in a moment. But first, let's go to your calls, Florida. Are you looking to buy, sell, or are you sitting it out, this crazy real estate market? 305-995-1800. Liz is calling from her home in Orlando. Hi, Liz.
Hi, good morning.
Yeah, go ahead.
Or afternoon.
Sure.
Yeah, my husband and I, we purchased our home a few years ago, and we have no designs to sell, even with the market really being a seller's market. But we have been getting solicitations in the mail, over the phone, via email, just people wanting to purchase our home or to sell our home and above market value, even from what we've been seeing. And it's wild, the demand right now.
It is, but you've decided you're just going to stick with what you've got, right?
Yeah, the buying and selling process is so stressful in general, even with as much opportunity as is out there. It took us long enough to find our home. We really love it. So we're not wanting to sell, and people just really want to try and buy our home, apparently.
I hear you, Liz, and we've experienced that in our own home here in Jacksonville. Thank you. That's Liz in Orlando. Professor Johnson, if you own a home in Florida, you're getting text messages, calls, emails from people that are desperate to buy your property. And but as you said, as crazy as this is right now, you think the market's going to cool off and prices are going to cool off at some point, and that is ultimately a good thing. Why do you feel that way?
Sure. Prices always cool. Housing prices do not grow to the sky. Eventually, and not in a very technical manner, but you can think of it, people eventually say those prices are just too high. And the market begins to cool. Now, there was a catastrophic effect last time around because it was the perfect storm. So, but still, the further you get above what's called a long-term pricing mean or a long-term pricing trend in housing, the greater the likelihood of damage and the greater the likelihood of the magnitude of that damage to housing prices. Again, we're nowhere near where we were a decade and a half ago, but we're pretty darn high. You're there in Jacksonville, and right now Jacksonville's coming in at about 20% above where they should be as a premium. Shockingly, that number was only 18% 30 days ago. In Orlando, I've got the numbers in front of me here. Orlando's coming in just short of 20%, and it was 18.5% premium that they were paying 30 days ago. So prices are rising very rapidly, and would love to see that slow down simply because it exposes us to a great level of risk that we don't really need to be exposed to at this point.
Yes, and we certainly, any of us who've lived here long enough, remember how bad things can get. Let's go to George and Kendall. George, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, my question goes to affordable housing in this crazy market. I'm in the process of trying to buy a place, and on more than one occasion, I've been beat out by conglomerates, partnerships, with millions, in some cases billions of dollars to spend, coming, putting in a cash offer for the same property I was offering a finance deal on.
Right.
And sometimes they'll come in even under the price I was offering. Every politician in the county talks about the affordable housing crisis and how they want to do something about it.
But this, yeah, you're right, George. This is making it so tough for people to get into the real estate market. Professor, just 30 seconds to the break. Real quick, should people just wait a while to buy?
I would say so. And if you have to find a place to stay right now, I would consider renting and reinvesting, rent and reinvest monies that you would otherwise spend on housing. And our research shows where you're going to end up in terms of wealth creation. It's going to be about the same. So one way to find an alternative now would be to rent and reinvest. But housing affordability is no doubt a problem in South Florida.
Yeah, it's a problem, I think, all over the state. And we hear this all the time. People just can't even get their foot in the door to buy a property right now. It's traditionally been the way to build wealth in this country. But maybe renting is a better choice in the short term. We'll continue the conversation with more of your calls and tweets in a moment. Ahead here on the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for listening this Friday as we get ready to head into the 4th of July holiday. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Tom Hudson is out this week, and we're continuing the conversation about Florida's crazy real estate market with Ken Johnson, Associate Dean, Professor, Real Estate Expert at Florida Atlantic University's College of Business. We'll go to a few more calls in a moment. 305-995-1800. Tweet us at Florida Roundup. Now, Professor, you were saying a moment ago, for people that just can't get into this overpriced housing market right now, you think renting would be a better option, renting and investing, and you also think that could help stabilize prices over the long term. Tell us more about that.
Sure. So there are really three choices that we have. You could rent and spend the difference that you would otherwise spend on housing, on consumption, We're kind of quasi-famous for saying spend it on beer and cookies, or you could rent and reinvest monies that you would spend on ownership, or you could own. And the first option is really no option for wealth creation. The other two we monitor with a buy versus rent index, BH&J, buy versus rent index, 23 major cities around the country. And our research continually shows there's a winner. And right now, depending on where you are in the country and depending on where you are in Florida, renting tends to win a little bit more right now. But some cities, ownership and building equity wins. But you know what? The difference is very small. So if you're really caught in a bind right now, one way to take some pressure off the housing prices in terms of ownership is to consider that renting and reinvesting. But then you have to have that discipline to make that monthly investment. What would I spend on maintenance? What would I spend on taxes, insurance, HOA, et cetera? Estimate that and put that into a portfolio of stocks and bonds. And the outcome difference might even be better for you. I know it would be on average in South Florida. Orlando and Tampa is pretty much toss up on that. So it will take pressure off the prices. It will stop driving prices up, and it will create wealth creation alternatives for a number of folks. Just remember, if you rent, make sure you reinvest.
Yes, indeed. State Representative Anna Eskamani is listening to the show. She just tweeted the Florida Roundup. She says, I have filed several bills for renters' rights and to allow local governments to stabilize rental rates. We've also fought for more funding for legal aid and rental assistance. We need to stop diverting affordable housing dollars in the state. And we're getting calls about that from a lot of renters out there. 305-995-1800. Janine is in Port St. Lucie. Hi, Janine. Are you a renter?
Yes, actually, I'm a renter, and I'm in the construction industry for residential construction.
Oh, so you know all about this. So what are your thoughts about the market?
Well, in regards to start off in regards to renting, I'm a renter, and one thing I'm definitely seeing is inflation with not just only gas and groceries, but we're also talking about rent. You know, rent is going so high in the Port St. Lucie area that really is getting to the point that people cannot afford a rent, so they want to go purchase a home. And what we're seeing is, like, it's like the previous caller said, it's just so impossible at this point to get your foot in the door. The competition is absolutely fierce. Even if you decide to build a new home, you know, a lot of these new homes now, they're not, you know, they're closing are getting pushed back because of lack of material. You know, we have a material shortage out in the field, and that's just not only with our company, but that's just an entire nationwide thing. So it's kind of like an interesting industry. Like, it's expensive to rent, but it's a time to buy, but it's not the time to build because you're risking the possibility of not having your home built on a timely manner because you're not going to have the materials that we need in order for us to complete the building process. And then also, you know, that the constant outbidding. So, you know, you can see a home and then you can put your house in the market and you'll get five offers the next day.
The next day, it's insane. So
It's really, really insane. And a lot of people, what they don't know, people in the construction industry and real estate industry, I mean, we're just being just as affected as people who are trying to buy a home. It's really, really competitive. It's just really cutthroat industry right now.
It's too bad, Janine, but I really appreciate you sharing your insights about it. We're getting lots of tweets, too. Here's one from a listener. We're searching for a West Central Florida rental, and we found landlords here are getting 400 applications per day, per property. Professor Johnson, I'm thinking back to 2008, 2009, and it was kind of like this then. But it's reassuring to hear you say we're not headed for a crash, because we're also getting calls and tweets from listeners who've been concerned about that.
So, again, the likelihood of a crash is there, but the magnitude is the question. I think we're going to get into a period of flat prices. We'll get back on our long-term pricing trend. You'll see housing affordability adjust over time. Housing affordability for the whole state, for the residents of the state, is a major, major issue, driven primarily by the overall lack of new construction. In the end, you can't really add to overall inventory by transferring a property from being a rental to maybe ownership, it's got to be built. And probably our biggest problem for creating more overall inventory in Florida and the nation as a whole is the application process, the zoning, permitting, et cetera, has become so draconian that it's almost impossible to start new product. Hmm. And until this is deregulated to a point, some point, we're not going to be able to build at the rate that we need to dig ourselves out of this hole. No pun intended. Affordability to some extent will disappear with a little settlement or a slowdown in prices, like it did last time, which, you know, during the crash, we stopped talking about housing affordability because it became wildly affordable.
Well, it sure did, but that wasn't a good thing. Did we learn our lesson, though? Did we learn our lesson from the last time? Are we seeing a repeat of the same mistakes that led us down a terrible path over a decade ago?
We've learned some lessons and not learned others. We've definitely learned about how to do better mortgage underwriting. We've definitely learned about a little bit of price control, as evidenced by the recent slowdown in mortgage applications for purchase. You're seeing again, yes, we're having a price run up, but nowhere near like it was during the last housing boom. But some things we haven't learned is, you know, how to create the inventory that we need. Interestingly enough, we were at excessive levels of inventory in 2006, which exacerbated the problem. So this shortage of inventory should help brace, support the coming real estate event. And again, I don't know how to describe it. I don't want to use the word bubble.
The coming real estate event. That sounds ominous.
I don't want to use bubble.
Okay. We won't say bubble. James is on the line in West Palm Beach. James, happy Friday. Go ahead.
Hello. You folks mentioned a good thought that my wife and I had to sell your house, and then you're in the rat race trying to compete with others. But my neighbor's a realtor, and he said it's not necessarily the case. I'm 62, she's 60. In 55-plus communities, there's not such a fight for those properties. These are younger people or whatever buying. So you can still, you know, we could sell and then move into a community, which I'd like to do anyway. And that could get around that problem of being in the same rat race as everybody else.
So you may do that then?
Very possibly.
Looking at that. That's interesting. Thank you, James.
We lost a daughter years ago, and we've had problems not wanting to leave because of memories. But
I'm sorry. Sorry to hear that.
But anyway, that was a big point that my neighbor realtor pointed out. That
Interesting.
There's not a price ruler in the 55-plus communities.
What about that, Professor Johnson?
No direct research being done on that, but I live here in the West. I live close to West Palm Beach now. And yes, you see a number of these communities, and that sounds like a reasonable possibility simply because you're just not going to have the same traffic flow into the demand patterns into those particular areas. So that sounds like a very reasonable alternative.
Well, it's good advice from you, Ken Johnson, to rent for now if you can, but invest as much as you can until you are in a position to buy. He's Ken Johnson, Associate Dean, Professor, Real Estate Expert at Florida Atlantic University's College of Business. Thanks so much for being with us this Friday here on the Florida Roundup.
Glad to have been here.
Well, this week, a federal judge put a hold on a first-of-its-kind law here in Florida. This controversial new law had authorized the state to penalize social media companies when they ban political candidates. Governor Ron DeSantis had made the new big tech law a high priority after Facebook, Twitter, YouTube all banned former President Trump after he incited the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. But on Wednesday, U.S. District Judge Robert Hinkle issued a preliminary injunction blocking enforcement of the law. It was scheduled to go into effect here in Florida on Thursday. Hinkle says the law's ban on deplatforming candidates likely violated the free speech rights of the tech companies. Give us a call, Florida, as we talk about this and First Amendment issues. 305-995-1800. What do you think of the judge's ruling? It's a loss, a setback for the governor. Tweet us at Florida Roundup. We're pleased to welcome Clay Calvert, professor of law, director of the Marion B. Breckner First Amendment Project at the University of Florida, and also with us Mary Ellen Kloss, Capitol Bureau Chief for the Miami Herald. Thanks to you both for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Good to be here.
Good to have you both. Let's begin with you, Professor Calvert. Judge Hinkle's ruling is seen as a win for the social media giants as they try to keep control of their platforms and decide who can stay and who can go. But do you also see it as a victory for the First Amendment?
Yes, it's definitely a victory for the First Amendment rights of the social media platforms, particularly the ones affected by this legislation, this new law. It only applied to those that have over 100 million users or generate more than $100 million of revenue annually. So the law basically discriminated against social media platforms based upon how many subscribers and how much money they made. It's a First Amendment victory because it says that they have the ability to control their platforms. The First Amendment protects us from government interference and government censorship. And essentially, this law was interfering with the ability of social media platforms to choose who it gets to deplatform. It's their choice to do. And in this case, the Florida law was interfering with that.
A little from the ruling, Judge Hinkle wrote, and I quote, like prior First Amendment restrictions, this is an instance of burning the house to roast a pig. Professor Calvert, what are your thoughts about that? Calling this an overreach, in other words.
Exactly right. Basically suggesting that this law was not narrowly tailored, which is, in other words, to pass the standard here for First Amendment scrutiny, it's called strict scrutiny. You got to show that there's a compelling interest, that Florida has a compelling interest in this law. And the judge said that there was not a compelling interest, that leveling the playing field, promoting speech on one side of an issue and not the other is not a compelling interest. And also the part about burning the house to roast the pig, that the law also has to be narrowly tailored, which means it has to be better crafted. So it's basically like, go back to the drawing board, Florida, if you want to do something, but you don't have a compelling interest, which is necessary. And even if you did, this law is far too broad to serve whatever interest you're asserting.
You're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Mary Ellen Kloss, Capitol Bureau Chief with the Miami Herald. What's been the reaction from the governor's office, and what can we expect from his legal team next, if anything?
Well, first of all, I think the governor anticipated that this would get challenged, which it did shortly after it was signed into law. And he, I think, is willing to take this even farther. You know, there the attorney general and the governor and the legislators who backed this law, you know, really tried to flip the First Amendment argument. They argued that the social media platforms themselves were engaging in censorship and violating users' speech rights because they didn't give people fair notice when they, you know, banned them from their platforms. So they're going to continue to push this. It is also something that is seen as a very helpful political argument for the governor. You know, he came up with this legislation shortly after former President Donald Trump was banned from both Facebook and Twitter and other social media platforms after supporters, you know, rampaged the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. Mm-hmm. So I think there is a lot of political advantage he sees in continuing to making this argument. So we're going to see it appealed.
Now, as we see it appealed, it's by far from the only move made by the governor that is facing legal pushback. Everything from banning transgender athletes in schools, transgender girls and women in Florida public schools, mandating viewpoint surveys on college campuses. that raises First Amendment issues as well. But Mary Ellen, as you say, these are all wedge issues that the governor is using to position himself for a compelling run for the presidency in 2024. Yes?
Well, that seems to be the speculation. He first must win re-election in Florida. It doesn't look like he will have any challenges on the Republican side. But he has increasingly been less focused on issues that sort of are central to Floridians,
right,
on with many of these issues, and more focused on things that really reach a national audience. So that speculation is that that is his goal here, is to sort of seed a campaign for 2024 and appeal to people across the nation with these really, you know, social wedge issues in many ways.
James in Miramar has thoughts. James, you're on the air. Go ahead, James.
Hello. Yes, hi. How are you?
Go ahead. We're almost to the break.
Okay, real quick. My question was basically, the state is a form of government. How come they are so quick to dip into these kinds of constitutional rights? But when it comes to things like gun rights, they are like hands off. Is it safe to say that the right is no longer seeing the Constitution as the law, but only for them at least?
We're going to have to put that question to our guests after the break, James. That's James in Miramar. We're going to continue the conversation about this here on the Florida Roundup. Get on the line now, 305-995-1800. Back in a moment. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. My co-host Tom Hudson is off this week. We're continuing the conversation now with Clay Calvert, directing the Breckner First Amendment Project at the University of Florida, and reporter Mary Ellen Kloss, Capitol Bureau Chief with the Miami Herald. 305-995-1800. Give us a call as we talk about a federal judge slapping down the governor in his attempt to punish big tech companies when they ban political candidates. Clay Calvert, the caller just before the break, said he feels that Florida's leadership is hypocritical, not doing enough, in his view, to regulate things like guns, but passing a law that essentially tries to regulate social media companies, or fine them anyway, when they deplatform people. You talked a little bit about the First Amendment issues around this. What are your thoughts about some voters out there feeling that the state engages in selective enforcement of selective regulation?
Well, it certainly is selective regulation here. You know, when you were going through the other types of laws that came up, you mentioned the intellectual freedom and viewpoint diversity, you know, surveys on campus. One that you didn't mention, I think is very important, though, to add to that list, is the anti-riot legislation that DeSantis also signed, the one that increases fines for people who may be protesting near violence that occurs in those types of situations. So you have really this steady drumbeat of law. So it certainly is political. I think all of this is politically motivated. But of course, you know, these are elected officials and they have the ability to choose which issues they want to focus. So the remedy is for voters to vote them out of office if they're not happy. So certainly the Florida legislature is Republican controlled, as the governor is a Republican. And so that's really their prerogative to do so. But indeed, it's picking and choosing the issues that I think at the larger level do appeal probably for a DeSantis run in 2024 for president.
As Mary Ellen said, that's if he does get reelected next year as governor. Tiger tweets the show, the deplatforming law was ridiculous from the get-go. The First Amendment only applies to the government's restriction of free speech. It does not prevent private individuals or entities from restricting access. 305-995-1800. And lots of calls coming into the show. Lisa in Palm Beach. Hi, Lisa. Go ahead.
Hi. So, Yes, I. What you just mentioned was exactly what I wanted to express, that I think we should be hesitant to restrict private businesses and from allowing and disallowing what they want to be on the air, but maybe, and to be spread to the public, but maybe because they are so powerful and so influential, we do want to regulate them in a way that maybe insist that they make the public aware that this is only one opinion, and also make sure that other voices can be heard through other forums. But at the same time, I think it's important to be cautious about regulating private businesses in this way.
Yeah. Thank you, Lisa. Mary Ellen Kloss, you know, the governor and others who really disagreed with the deplatforming of former President Trump argue that these platforms are so big that they've become so powerful that you can't mount a campaign. You can't get a going concern lift off for it if you're not on social media. That said, you can always start your own website. You can always find other ways of expressing your view. It's a separate argument from whether I think these platforms have become so big that they need to be broken up or regulated in some way. And, you know, there's sentiment to do that both on the left and the right. But I think it's separate from this issue of deplatforming politicians that violate the terms of service. What are your thoughts?
You know, I think that's a really good point. And it's very true that there has been a lot of discussion at the federal level in Congress for what to do with these platforms. They really, in many ways, have become serving a bit of a quasi-governmental role by governing speech and discerning from their point of view what is protected speech and what is not. But that's their prerogative under our First Amendment law, that because they're private companies, they can decide who they want to ban and who they want to allow. And they claim to want to be doing it with a social good. And so that's where there's argument. But it's very different from what the state was trying to do. And I think that's the distinction that Judge Hinkle really honed in on. He basically said the law was riddled with imprecision and ambiguity. And so the way the state attempted to draft this legislation, didn't have anything to do with breaking up the big companies. They were using that argument as the reason for motivating this need for regulation at the state level. But what they ultimately succeeded at doing didn't get at what their argument was. And I think we're going to, you know, in many ways, there is a positive side to this, and that is that it has elevated this debate and perhaps informed more legislators about the problem. And maybe that will then be a catalyst for seeing some changes at the federal level. I know that the platforms themselves have called for clearer and more clarification of the existing regulations.
You're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Lee is calling in from Miami. Hey, Lee, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Thank you. Well, first, you covered part of what I wanted to say about the First Amendment is only about the government not interfering with speech. But there's a flip side to that, which is you cannot scream fire in a crowded theater. That's where you go from free speech to criminal activity. And I think the same thing applies on social media for screaming insurrection or overthrow of the government. You're endangering lives. You're endangering the country. And I think that banning that is the same as dealing with the illegality of screaming fire in a crowded theater.
Thanks, Lee. Professor Calvert, our First Amendment expert. That's always been the argument about free speech, that when you do come up to a line of harming others, your free speech rights will be curtailed. Is that a fair analogy?
That is a fair analogy. Yeah, the quote is that you cannot falsely shout fire in a crowded theater. Mm-hmm. Of course, if there is a fire, you can shout it all you want.
Right.
But that's a really good point the caller makes. Incitement to violence, unlawful action or violence is not protected by the First Amendment. It's a very high threshold to make. So when we think about President Trump or former President Trump in January 6th and the events that happened there. The government would have to prove, if it were to prosecute Trump, that he actually intended to incite imminent lawless action and that it was likely to occur. So the question would be, what was his intent that day? Was it likely to occur, and was it imminent? The imminence between his speech there at the rally seems pretty clear. The question is, what about his intent? So certainly the caller makes a really good point that incitement to violence is one of those few categories, like obscenity, child pornography, true threats, certain types of defamation, obviously, are not protected by the First Amendment. So there are definitely limits on how far your free speech rights go.
Tammy in Jacksonville. Hi, Tammy. Thanks for calling the show. Go ahead.
Having me. My concern is who is paying for all these lawsuits? We've had two governors now that have pushed through numerous lawsuits that even as a layman I know are ridiculous. It's like, that's not going to go anywhere. So who's paying for all these things?
Yeah. Well, typically we do, Tammy, the taxpayers. Mary Ellen Kloss, there is some frustration among some taxpayers out there around Florida that the governor has pursued all of these, as you describe them, these red meat wedge issues that are unlikely to make it through the courts. The legal challenges do cost money. And will taxpayer funds be used to defend the state or represent the state in all of these actions?
There is no doubt they will be used.
Yeah, right. And how much is that going to cost?
Well, I think we added up, it wasn't at the end of Rick Scott's tenure, but maybe 6 years into his 2-year term, we added up about $9 million in legal bills that were paid on lost legal challenges.
Wow.
This
That's not nothing. Yeah.
Been here for 3 years, and we're going to continue. There's so many in the pipeline. I mean, as Clay mentioned, there's challenges from the anti-riot bill. There's numerous challenges, and then once, even though this bill was enjoined and blocked by Judge Hinkle, it's going to be challenged at the appellate level. And that's very expensive. And then if they lose there, though, or either side is likely to challenge it at the U.S. Supreme Court level. So these costs are going to continue for a long time.
Right. And there's quite a few, as you said, Clay Calvert. There's the anti-riot law. There's the new law requiring students and professors to give their political viewpoints on campus. That will be challenged. The transgender ban for athletes. There have been a few others that are certain to go through the system. And yes, it does cost the taxpayers millions. So I'm glad we were able to include that in this conversation. 30 seconds left. Professor Calvert, your final thoughts.
Sure. There's also another cost on that, too. To the extent that under federal law, you're claiming a civil rights violation, and the First Amendment is obviously a civil right. If you prevail against a governmental entity in a civil rights violation case, then that governmental entity, in this case, the state of Florida, has to reimburse you for your attorney's fees and costs. So not only would Florida be defending it here and paying for its own defense of the law,
more adding
it
up, yeah.
Ultimately, it will be
more money. Yeah. Clay Calvert, UF, Mary Ellen Kloss, Miami Herald. Thank you both for being with us.
Thank you.
And that's our show. The Florida Roundup comes to you by WJCT Public Media in Jax, WLRN Public Media in Miami. Heather Schatz and Andrea Paderma are producers. Jessica Bateman helped this week, too. Technical director is Peter Mertz, with engineering help from Doug Peterson, Charles Michaels, and Josh Torres. Richard Ives answers the phones, and theme music by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at aaronlibos.com. I'm Melissa Ross. Have a safe and happy 4th of July weekend, and listen to Florida Public Radio for the latest on Hurricane Elsa.